Okay, do we have any comments or questions or contributions? Yeah?
Yeah. Obviously, opening remarks, it's very frustrating sometimes to hear Marx so portrayed in a one-dimensional way, because he was someone of great learning and, like myself, was stimulated by philosophical ideas initially, didn't have a political background. I was very interested in this whole idea of the ideas not existing on their own but coming from material situations. We know about that. Whilst that is true for a large number of ideas, is it also true, for instance, and the idea that interests me is what the origin of consciousness was? I have many thoughts about that. That idea does not seem to be dependent on my material conditions in any way. The ideas I float about that, the patterns I form, the possible solutions, I'm influenced in certain ways, insofar as I'm certain it's not God-given. But apart from that, there are so many theories about those possibilities. It seems to me that their ideas in that area do float on their own.
Well, I've looked up all sorts of things thinking, well, I might be asked this and I might be asked that and I might be asked something else. But I didn't think of that one. But I don't actually see where ideas can come from unless they come from outside, from the real world. I mean, I have heard it discussed before that how can you think without words? You think of the animal kingdom and they have sort of communications with each other, and that as far as we know they're not using words, or no words that we can understand. And you have the problem with people who are born without the ability to speak without sight or hearing, that's right, and how they can get on in the world. And it was the famous people, they're so famous that I can't remember their names just now, that where the child that was in that situation was misbehaving and so on, but a teacher came along who was able to begin to show the relationship between things and words, and the woman became a writer and so on, but I can't remember her name. But I don't see how you can have the ideas unless they're coming in from outside. I mean, if you grew up on your own on an island, you know, and never met anyone, you wouldn't have any. You wouldn't have any speech, but you would have the information around you and would be reacting to the things around you. But I don't know. I mean, maybe someone else.
Yeah.
I've got sympathy with that, but I actually think it's the cart before the horse. The proposition, you know, do we need language, words to think? Mm-hmm. And I've heard that argued that, in fact, mathematicians don't need words, they actually use symbols, they use numbers. Now, see, I think that concept, those concepts, are based upon things like the work of Chomsky and all these 20th century ideas, which were based on other things. In other words, these ideas haven't arisen on their own. They're a product of our history. The fact that we can talk about consciousness like this is something that's developed over a long period. This conversation wouldn't make sense, say, 100 years ago, 200 years ago. You know, I'm not saying, I mean, I've heard it argued, for example, philosophically, that, you know, the Greeks, somebody talking about postmodernism, saying, well, actually, Greeks were really arguing about this sort of stuff, they were just using different terms. Well, yes, there maybe is certain ideas that human beings throw up and discuss, but they're part of a historical epoch. If we were in an island, or if we had no electricity, our priorities of what we're thinking about would be very different.
But of course, you're right about the Greeks. Heraclitus wrote about atoms, and the Greeks wrote about many of the philosophical problems in very lucid ways, often more lucid than modern writers write about them. But the point I'm making is, of course, consciousness is a reality. We have it. We know that. It exists. We don't quite know what it is and how it got there, but we know it exists. It's something that we have. My point is that even if we accept that, just class that as being material, the fact that we have it, and it's a reality of our life, in thinking about that, you may start to think about it like, say, the double helix. There may have been science behind the family of the double helix, but the idea of the shape itself was independent of the solution. And it brought the solution, but the idea, the pattern, and often patterns of thought without evidence can lead to something else. Now, whether this, you may say the stimulus originally was the fact that we were aware that we did have this, it's just an interesting problem that fascinates me. And I hate to be thought that, in a way, it sort of means that everything I do or say is determined, if you take that view. That's my take on it. It's an interesting subject.
I'm not sure that I follow why you think that everything we say or do is determined.
Well, it, ultimately, if you trace it all back, if the double helix was determined by another thought, and that was determined by another thought, and that was determined by another thought, everything, there must be something pre-existing every thought I have. Is that necessarily true?
Can I just say, I think it's a false proposition. When somebody's got some ideas, and say, for example, the idea of the shape of the double helix, it was a rather like fitting together Lego, where there was no predisposition for that to happen there and then. What's fascinating about these kind of propositions is that often different people are thinking about the same problem simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why would that happen if it's not historical?
Yes, I've just written down Darwin and Wallace. Yes, if one person can have the idea, then there's no reason why another person can't have the same idea.
Because they're working upon the same kind of knowledge base, but this whole concept of originality. Is it anything really original? Oh, no, we just put together ideas in different ways.
Well, I don't want to pursue this point, but I would still disagree with that fundamental proposition in an essential way, as far as I'm concerned. I don't want to pursue this because it's counterproductive, really. We could go on forever and never reach a conclusion, like trying to reach a conclusion about the origin of consciousness. We're not where we can do it. Well, it'd be interesting to talk about it when you start to.
Okay. Anyone else want to talk about it? Yeah?
Can I just speak one point about it? I thought the idea of talking about how the development of capitalism, I've read a little bit, not Marx, but actually about Marx and about interpretation and discussion. And one of the things that struck me was that if capitalism isn't actually overthrown, and people don't make the conscious choice to get rid of it, then things will become more miserable, even if materially we might find some way of surviving, because of the alienation, which you were talking about, say, the stress. But, I mean, it's interesting that our society, has lots of mental illness and things, and that is a fairly new phenomenon. I don't really think it's something that has always been with us.
Thanks.
I just think the idea that you actually kind of came up, I mean, I don't know the theme, the history of humiliation, but it just struck me as amazing that he didn't think he wasn't deterministic about the idea that capitalism would be thrown. He'd actually thought, my goodness, it might, you know, they might find some way of actually doing what they're doing now, making us into infants and playing with gadgets and toys and things like that. And in fact life would become really miserable. He actually could think that his ideas wouldn't take off and the ideas of positive, you know, progressive thinkers wouldn't take off. And that, you know, the kind of counter revolutionary ideas, a way of them actually wanting to maintain themselves.
Yes. Yeah, there is this, because this idea that his ideas have been tried, and then that his ideas led to these oppressive dictatorships, and that is a very big stumbling block. And quite recently, there was discussion following an article being in the Standard, and people were actually saying, well, you know, Marxists really don't want to have anything to do with that, you know, and people who were saying that, well, that wasn't what Marx had meant, that was only. That they somehow took that to mean you're just sort of making that excuse that it wasn't what he was meant, but it still was. So you got that sort of stumbling block to get through. I think that possibly they would have been excited to hear about the Russian Revolution, but then I wouldn't have thought it would have taken long, as indeed in this party we're pretty quickly aware that it couldn't be at the time such a revolution. But there are things, and well, I've actually got two copies of the Communist Manifesto here, because one was my father's copy and it's this bit worn, but this one actually has the preface to the Russian edition that the older copy doesn't have, and that has a piece at the end. I mean, I've been telling Darren a book that I read recently about the world that never was, and unusually for me, I haven't written down the author, so I can't tell you, except I think he was a journalist. But he says about, you know, Marx predicted that the revolution would come first there, but he doesn't give sources, and he has several things about, throwaway things about Marx, but doesn't give sources of where he said them. But looking at this, at the preface to the Russian edition, it says that the... I'm not going to read because two paragraphs. And now Russia, during the revolution of 1848-49, not only the European princes, but the European bourgeois as well, found their only salvation from the proletariat in Russian intervention. Then it goes on later on, the manifesto had as its object the proclamation of the inevitably impending dissolution of modern bourgeois property. But in Russia, we find, face to face with the rapidly developing capitalist swindle and bourgeois landing property just beginning to develop, more than half the land owned in common by the peasants. Now, the question is, can the Russian... there's a Russian word there, I think, but... though greatly undermined, yet a form of the primeval common ownership of land passed directly to the higher form of communist common ownership? Or on the contrary, must it pass through the same process of dissolution as constitutes the historical evolution of the West? And it says the only answer to that possible today, and this is 1882, if the Russian Revolution becomes the signal for a proletarian revolution in the West, so that both complement each other, the present Russian common ownership of land may serve as the starting point for a communist development. So that is one of the kind of things that I think are taken to being that he was thinking of it happening first in Russia, though I don't interpret it that way. It was this particular thing about the common ownership of land, though elsewhere he also says about the peasants on the land already being turned into proletariat, you know, being forced off the land. And there's this sort of thing with him accused of being authoritarian. that I left all these things out of the talk because I thought we'd be here all day, sort of a dessert, but I thought that might come up in the discussion. But one of the things about him being accused of being authoritarian is because the anarchists, of course, see the problem in the state and want to abolish the state, whereas Marx thought that the state could be used, but not as happened in Russia. You know, this pretense that we've got this now, and if you work hard, we'll have the other thing later. But that there has to be the sort of the organisation. I mean, the anarchists like backing him were going and holding mini insurrections. You know, sort of attacking a town hall, destroying the documents in there, and waiting for the peasant rising. And this was not something that Marx supported. It opposed the conspiracy thing and these sort of tactics that it had to be a political action and he thought that you could use political action to achieve something that then you didn't need the politics anymore, whereas the anarchists thought that that using politics was wrong. You've got to have this forceful sort of action going on. It had to be more organised. Engels said there was nothing more authoritarian than blowing up people with your bombs and things for the revolution.
Okay, Richard.
That's strange because it was that misreading that took me away from anarchy. Though I still consider myself anarchic in most of my behaviour, but it took me to socialism because they focused on entirely the wrong thing. Whether the state exists or not, and in what form, and how you define the state, was not the main question. The main question was that Marx believed the changed society would arise through uncoerced human beings choosing it. An anarchist should welcome that position, but instead, over a long, long period, and they still willfully misrepresent that position. The focus is on how that condition arises, not what you call it. Marx emphasised that, didn't he? He did.
Yeah.
And the worst thing is to find him portrayed as some sort of dogmatist who wants to trap us all into some channel of behaviour, and that is completely the opposite, of course, to what he actually believed.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say, my understanding of Marx wasn't that he thought there would be a revolution in Russia. In fact, he believed that the economy had to be developed, there had to be capitalism, and there had to be a large proletariat because they had collective labour and understood their collective power. And that when Lenin seized power in Russia and the Second Revolution and got rid of the Soviets and all the rest, he thought that the revolution was actually happening in Germany, which I believe was what Marx had thought, since at that point it was the most developed economy. Mm-hmm. And partly the justification for war communism was that they had kind of hold on to the Russian state, waiting for the Europeans to rise. And this didn't happen. And one of the arguments with the anarchists was that the anarchists had, although we're talking here about history and there was lots of different developments going on, but one of the things was that they didn't think this was a precondition for the revolution, that a peasant was just as likely to create the condition of a free society and a cooperative society as the proletariat. And one of the reasons why they opposed the Bolsheviks in Russia was because they actually saw it was a dual, I believe it was a dual power situation between the Soviets as the representatives of the new society and the government, the provisional government. And the fact that Lenin moved against the provisional government and replaced it with the Bolsheviks and then suppressed the Soviets, they saw that as a vindication of their analysis of the flaw in Marx. Whereas, I mean, I tend to think that Lenin was, this is not a very good analogy, but I've heard it used, where St. Paul came along and turned the teaching of Jesus Christ on its head, and it was exactly the same with Lenin and Marx. Lenin just turned Marxism upside down, and you know, they just used the same labels, you know, Christianity in terms of the teachings of St. Paul, and kind of authoritarianism of the Christianity and the founding of the Christian Church, and the Bolsheviks, who then re-christened themselves the Communist Party and took on the mantle of Marxism and Engels. But in fact, had grabbed hold of, because they substituted themselves, instead of the proletariat as the vanguard of the working class, the party became the vanguard of the working class. It was substitutionalism. And inevitably, would lead to defeat, because they actually had to suppress some of the most conscious elements within Christian society. But I think there is a kind of historic clash between anarchism and Marxism. And I think there is more of a fusion now, given to early 21st century, where lots of people who term themselves libertarians, who come from a kind of anarchist tradition and a Marxist tradition. Because in a sense, the means of production is at such an advanced stage, and global capitalism at such a point where it would be possible to move into a free society. It's not as it was, say, in Russia in 1917.
Okay, anyone else planning to say anything about Marx or free will or determinism?
Or would you like a coffee first?
Or we could have a coffee break and resume.
Can I just pick up on that point? It's actually a better analogy than you think. Because as an ex-Christian as well as an ex-anarchist, I know a bit about that. And of course, what Paul did was serve the state. Whereas if Jesus lived, what he purported to say was the opposite. You must hate your mother and father. If you want to take on board my ideas, you must be your own person. And it was a completely different message, even from the scriptures they passed on, when that from St. Paul. It was St. Paul, obey your slaves, obey your masters, and all that crap that completely distorted the early historical view of Jesus. And what the view that the early Christians indeed had, they weren't Paulites. And so it's a much closer analogy. You think he's been distorted as someone, okay, may have claimed he was God, but in fact there's strong evidence to say he never said any such thing if he existed, which he probably did.
I was a wee bit tentative about it because I don't know much about Christianity, to be
honest. It's actually quite close because it's the opposite of what he actually was purported to have said.
Piece that I looked up about Khrushchev in 1961. You remember the famous time when he did the rebutting Stalin, and he gave the speech and said what had happened under Stalin, and someone called out, well, why didn't you, or whatever he said, do something about it, and Khrushchev didn't answer. So there was dead silence. And then after a bit, he said, well, you have your answer. You know, that's why he hadn't done anything at the time. But anyway, that wasn't really what I was going to say. But he said they were adopting a program for building a communist society. he promised that the present generation would see communism. Communist principle of distribution according to need would be implemented in the 80s, according to Khrushchev. And I put it as fine words to gain support for an anti-Stalinist reform program. But he proposed that there was going to be some production and enterprises allowed to keep some of the profits, but it wasn't generally applied, as this would have meant dismantling the state centralised planning. So the reforms failed and the Russian economy stagnated in terms of productivity and technological advance. So then along comes Gorbachev in 1986, who had to admit that the idea had been premature, and also that setting time limits on the task of constructing communism was premature. In other words, communism had been postponed indefinitely. So though they did, because you all know what's been happening there since. It struck me as being rather like here, where you used to say, well, there's going to be prosperity, but you've got to work hard, for it, particularly sort of in the post-war, this carrot thing, that there's good times coming. But there it was going to be even better. It didn't work out. It was rather sort of disappointing that there weren't millions of people in Russia who knew what communism really was and were only waiting, for the wall to come down, as it were, and they'd all be ready for instigating a communist revolution. But
it is extraordinary when you think, how in the 30s, when my friend Alfred Reynolds, I'm writing about, joined a communist party. He left when Stalin killed Kirov for his friends, and he denounced him. And so Rajek, who was the Minister of the Interior of Hungary, betrayed him to the fascist police. But then, I wish I'd known this about him when he was alive, because I would have asked him the question why he waited till then. But then, looking into further research of his papers, I found the explanation that, in common with the vast majority of people at that time, they were fearful of either of National Socialism or Communism, and they thought their only option was to step in one camp or the other, whichever they thought was the lesser evil. Mm. There's a very interesting thing on the whole historical development of things and how those basic ideas were rooted in people's minds and lost. Khrushchev himself, with Gorbachev, was the most interesting of the prime ministers, because he freed thousands and thousands of prisoners in Crimea. He opened up the press. He was the first one to do it. And as a result of that, what got him deposed was that the Western governments took advantage to put more spies in Russia than ever before. And this was pointed out to him, and he was thrown out. So this is what opening up does. Fascinating that even then, and Khrushchev of course had his hands covered with blood the same as everybody else, but even then it must have taken something for him to stand up and say that against Uncle Joe.
Yes, they said he stopped the knock on the door in the night. Yes.
Which was of course with Beria and all that knock. So I always had a bit of stuff, and he was funny as well. We used to make a lot of jokes. He's the only one who did. Now all that lot, he used to tell jokes. But of course, but I bet you now that a lot of people in Russia are regretting that they kicked Gorbachev out. What they've got now.
Oh dear, yes.
Just taken a few steps backwards.
Can you elaborate a bit more about the, I think it's Alex Butterworth's book.
Yes, thank you.
The World That Never Was.
Yes.
It would be good to hear your thoughts if you've read that, because I think it's probably quite an important book to look at in terms of conspiratorial kind of politics and that kind of thing.
I just write his name down.
Politics engaged in by, I'm talking conspiratorial politics, also engaged in by the state, of course.
Yeah.
the state was infiltrating various groups.
Oh, yes,
so
yes.
Therefore it highlights our kind of position within the framework of being open and transparent about getting from here to there.
Yeah, but he's...
I haven't read the book, but I do want to read that.
Well, good luck.
Good luck.
It was one of those books that I pressed on to the end and
wondered
why.
Right.
But he has, he doesn't have anything much about theories. It's about the actions of these various folk.
Yeah.
All sorts of some I'd heard of and some I hadn't heard of.
Yeah.
But he is very sort of unfavourable to Marx. So that he said, you know that the Paris Commune, Marx didn't have anything to do with it, and he said it was the uprising of a city, as it were. But this Butterworth said, despite Marx endorsing and he named as his emissaries to the Commune, while he stayed in London to nurse a conveniently recurring kidney complaint. And that's his kind of attitude to Marx, as though he was using that as an excuse not to go. And it's unnecessary.
Yeah, sure, despite that, I don't think Alex Butterworth's an anarchist or anything, is he? Despite his sort of misreading or... belittling of Marx or whatever, it's still probably quite a useful book to read about the shenanigans of what was going on in the time.
Oh yes, and about the what the state did.
Yeah, yeah.
The infiltration, as it were, of things. Yeah,
There's a few short articles about Marx and the anarchists and about the dictatorship of the proletariat, so-called, by David Adam, which has been written quite recently.
No, I haven't seen that.
Because the phrase dictatorship back then wouldn't have the same connotations as you'd think now, because it was before the time of fascist dictatorships. And But then, of course, you've got the quote, haven't you? What, I think it's Engels, isn't it, when he says the Paris Commune, that was the dictatorship of the proletariat.
Yeah, yes, because they had these elections and recall of people and so on,
But they seem to get stuck as much as anyone else, anarchists. I mean, this phrase, they have the tyranny of the minority.
An
absurd concept. Which shows a complete understanding of what we are about to start.
Mm.
I don't think all anarchists. People like Malatesta talked about that.
Yeah.
But not all.
No, of course not. Yeah. All anarchists are anything, but that's good. No, they do get stuck on these things. I've had debates with them and they come out with that all the time.
Somewhere.
Could I just ask? I think, the workers' movement, to give it a phrase, has progressed. I think, for example, in the 19th century, the anarchists had no real notion of psychology and the propaganda by deed. What a naive idea. And the kind of individualism, all that sort of stuff going on. But you can see where it's people attempting to develop ideas and rejecting wholesale often things that they saw as oppressive. But I feel, on the other hand, that Marx did underestimate the tenacity of the armed body, the state. That there is laws working within the organs of the state. They are tenacious. One of the things that always struck me was, I remember reading something, nothing to do with politics, it was actually sociology from the Reddit, about the police force, and saying, they love it when something's made illegal. Another drug to be illegal, great, more law enforcement. They're never going to actually make themselves redundant. They're always going to find a reason for their existence. And I tend to feel that, well, the anarchists were incredibly optimistic in terms of kind of the way people were thinking. The idea that, you know, you burn all the tax records and suddenly all the peasants are going to say, hurrah, I'm free. Exactly the same, you know, as if, you know, the black slaves and the plantations in America, you know, after the end of the American Civil War. Most of them were terrified. They didn't move off the plantations at all. Who's going to feed me now? You know, what happens now? But it was also a naivety that the Marxists had about the state and about the tenacity and the way it is. It will manifest itself where, if bourgeois democracy begins to lose its power, then you get this fascism, you know, and it comes in all shapes and forms.
We know those powers exist still in every state.
Yeah.
And I came across them many times in my years of demonstrating. And if they don't want you to go anywhere, they have a simple rule. They declare it out of bounds. That's a law. They can declare anywhere they want out of bounds, but any length, short or long. That is the law. All these laws for oppression are deeply buried. And if whatever it is, they'll find one somewhere. But, of course, anarchists must have got as frustrated as Marxists. And when I was an anarchist, I gave a talk at a school once and went on with a cloak and a bomb, because that is what most people thought of, which is a discredit to the great anarchist tradition of free thought, of course. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, that's the way of the world.
Another thing with Marx in the state is, his original plan for what became Capital was going to include a book on the state. And so, I mean, you only get partial commentary on what he really thought, I suppose, about the state relationship.
That's true, but I think the key thing is this thing I pointed out earlier, that he firmly believed that the change would come about through the human dynamic and it would be non-coercive.
Mm.
That to me seems to be one of the most important foundations of everything he said.